VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, state and local officials around the United States have again started rolling back social distancing rules. Officials in some areas had lifted similar restrictions in the past, but reordered them again when coronavirus infections increased. While some Americans welcome the move, health experts warn that it will again increase infections, illnesses, and deaths. In the state of Mississippi, officials are now permitting restaurants to expand their visitor limit to 75%. New Jersey decided to reopen exercise centers and permit indoor dining with limited capacity. Organized sports returned in Michigan, and parts of Florida are now considering an end to mask requirements. Bars can reopen in some parts of Florida at 50% capacity with some safety measures in place. But Florida's three biggest areas, Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach, are keeping bars closed because of high case numbers. Allie Preston and her husband, Zach, visited the Leon Pub in Florida's capital, Tallahassee. "We've been cooped up for a while. It was nice to have normalcy," Allie told the Associated Press. In other areas, American football fans gathered to cheer on their team without face coverings. Supporters of President Donald Trump attended an indoor campaign event over the weekend outside Las Vegas, Nevada. The event violated a rule set by the state's governor that limits indoor and outdoor gatherings to 50 people. While officials urged face masks, many attendees did not wear them. On Wednesday, the Big Ten, a major college conference, announced it will play football games this season. The move followed decisions by the Big 12 and Atlantic Coast conferences to also hold games. Just 5 weeks ago, the Big Ten said it would not play sports in autumn because of concerns over player safety. The latest decision came even though many students are still not permitted to return to classes in person. State officials are not the only ones easing social distancing restrictions. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the Roman Catholic Archbishop said he will no longer excuse people from in-person worship unless they are sick or are caring for someone who is. Coronavirus infections, however, are rising in Wisconsin.
A new report says the COVID-19 health crisis has greatly harmed worldwide efforts to reduce poverty and improve health care. The Goalkeepers report was released this week by the nonprofit Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The report is published yearly to present the latest progress by the organization and its partners. An introductory statement notes that in past reports, the organization has celebrated decades of historic progress in fighting poverty and disease. This year, however, we have to confront the current reality with candor. This progress has now stopped. The Goalkeepers report follows progress on 17 goals that world leaders set in 2015 in an agreement known as the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. The goals center on ways to end poverty, fight inequality, and reduce climate change by 2030. The report said progress was stopped or slowed in nearly all areas of the UN goals. The COVID-19 pandemic has pushed the extreme poverty level worldwide to 7%. The health crisis has ended a 20-year run of progress, the report found. Already in 2020, the pandemic has pushed almost 37 million people below the $1.90 a day extreme poverty line. The numbers are based on information gathered by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. The Institute is a research center at the University of Washington. It shares data with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The report also noted a sharp drop in overall vaccine coverage. The IHME said coverage fell to levels last seen in the 1990s. Child vaccinations for diseases such as measles and diphtheria dropped from a record high of more than 80% last year to 70% in 2020. In other words, we've been set back about 25 years in about 25 weeks, the report said. The report also noted International Monetary Fund predictions that the world economy will lose $12 trillion or more by the end of 2021. That would be the biggest worldwide GDP loss since the end of World War II. The report said there is no such thing as a national solution to a global crisis. All countries must work together to end the pandemic and begin rebuilding economies. I'm Brian Lynn.
Imagine you are watching an American film or television show, a mystery, for example. You hear one of the actors say the following words.
I myself am going to Boston.
You might stop and think about what you heard. Why would the speaker say, I myself? That question will be our subject on Everyday Grammar. Today, we will explore the mysterious world of intensive pronouns. But first, what exactly is a pronoun?
Pronouns are words that take the place of nouns in a sentence. There are three terms you need to understand: personal pronouns, reflexive pronouns, and intensive pronouns. We will explore each in turn. Personal pronouns are words such as my or our. Personal pronouns have different forms depending on where they are in the sentence. They can take the place of the subject, object, and so on. Personal pronouns are the starting place for reflexive pronouns. English speakers generally make reflexive pronouns by adding the terms self or selves to the personal pronoun. For example, in the first person, the singular pronoun my becomes myself. The plural pronoun our becomes ourselves. Before we get to intensive pronouns, let us stop and think about why pronouns are useful. Consider this sentence.
Bob hit Bob while Bob was hammering a nail.
Note that the noun Bob appears 3 times in the sentence. Such a sentence is a little clumsy, much like poor Bob. What if some of the nouns were replaced by pronouns? Then the sentence could be,
Bob hit himself while he was hammering a nail.
Or this,
Bob hit himself while hammering a nail.
In each sentence, the noun Bob appears once. The word himself, a reflexive pronoun, refers to Bob. And the personal pronoun he also means Bob. What about intensive pronouns? Intensive pronouns have the same form as reflexive pronouns. The difference is in how they are used.
In a sentence, the intensive pronoun serves as an appositive, a word or group of words that renames a noun. Appositives tell more information about a noun or noun phrase. Imagine you hear some Americans talking about their favorite food. You might hear one of them say any one of the following lines.
Myself, I prefer pizza. I myself prefer pizza. I prefer pizza myself.
In our examples, the intensive pronoun myself renames the subject of the sentence, the word I. Note that the intensive pronoun appears at the beginning, middle, or end of the sentence. It does not have to appear next to the noun or pronoun that it is renaming, although in many cases it does. You might be wondering why English speakers use the intensive pronoun. It refers to the same thing as the subject of the sentence. What information could it add? The answer is this. The intensive pronoun gives more emphasis or force to a statement. That is why intensive pronouns are sometimes called emphatic reflexive pronouns. If you are unsure whether a word is acting like an intensive pronoun or reflexive pronoun, you can do a kind of test. If you remove the intensive pronoun, the sentence should still be complete. This is because appositives give more information. You can remove the information and the sentence will still work. For example,
I told him myself
becomes
I told him.
Now let's do the same test on a sentence with a reflexive pronoun.
He cut himself while shaving.
If you remove himself, the sentence is no longer complete. We began this report with the line from an imaginary film or television show.
I myself am going to Boston.
Now you know that the speaker used the words I myself to add more force to the statement. Perhaps she has had a disagreement with someone else about where to go. Perhaps she wants to show that she has made a different choice. The next time you are watching a program, listen to how the speakers use intensive pronouns. Over time, you will begin to understand the important information that such pronouns can give. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared war on Britain in 1812. It did so because Britain refused to stop seizing American ships that traded with France, Britain's enemy in Europe. Sometimes there were also seizures of American sailors. These seizures were known as impressment. Britain finally suspended its orders against neutral trade after a change in government. But the British acted too late. The United States had already declared war. Today, we continue the story of the War of 1812. Most of Britain's forces were battling the soldiers of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe. Historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Alan Taylor says that as a result, the British could send only a small force to the United States.
And so the British were basically fighting the war against the United States on the defensive in Canada while trying to raid the American coast using their advantage in the more powerful Royal Navy.
For its part, the United States was far from ready to fight. The country had not fought a war or needed an army for a long time. There were only 8,000 American soldiers. The soldiers, who were young, knew little about war. And the officers who knew about war were old enough to have led troops in the American Revolution. President James Madison named two top generals, 62-year-old Henry Dearborn and 63-year-old Thomas Pinckney. The United States had only a few warships and gunboats with which to face the British Navy, the most powerful naval force in the world. Historian and professor Alan Taylor says the American people were divided about the war.
A majority of them supported the Madison administration and agreed that they tried the embargo, it had failed, and that something had to be done because national honor, they felt, was at stake, and that they needed to stop the British practice of impressment. And they were also upset about the British military aid to these Indian peoples who were restricting American expansion.
Alan Taylor says, for those reasons, many Americans supported the war, particularly in the southern, western, and mid-Atlantic states.
But in New England, most of the people supported the opposition party, the Federalists, and they were very bitter about the war. They felt that it was really being waged for illegitimate reasons, that diplomacy could have just papered over the disagreement over impressment. And so they did their best to obstruct the war effort. They not only didn't want to contribute to the war effort, but they wanted to block it as best they could.
Church bells were rung and flags were lowered in New England when the declaration of war was announced. There was also the problem of getting enough men to serve as soldiers. Congress had approved an increase of 25,000 men. Only 5,000 agreed to serve. Members of Congress from the western states had spoken proudly of how their people would rush to fight the British. This did not happen. The first request to Kentucky for soldiers produced only 400 men. Historian Alan Taylor says that some states in the Northeast did not offer any soldiers at all, especially for invasions into Canada.
And even when the governors would cooperate, as did, for example, the governor of New York, the militia would often march to the border and then decide that their constitutional duty was only to defend their state and not to help the United States invade another country. And so they'd go on a sit-down strike once they got to the border.
Nevertheless, an American general named William Hull led 2,000 men across the Canadian border. But the British general there was prepared, and the attack failed. Although Hull had the stronger force and plenty of supplies, he retreated to Detroit. He was chased by a smaller force of British soldiers and Indians. After the war, Hull was tried by a military court on charges of cowardice. The court found him guilty and ordered him shot. But President Madison, because of Hull's service during the Revolutionary War, permitted the old soldier to live. The next American attack was made from Fort Niagara, a military post in New York on the shore of Lake Ontario. A small group of American soldiers crossed the Niagara River and attacked the British. But some Americans from New York refused to cross the border to help against the British. They calmly watched as British soldiers shot down the attacking Americans. The third campaign was made by General Henry Dearborn. He led a state militia force from Plattsburgh, New York, to the Canadian border. He was planning to cross the border and attack Montreal. But again, the soldiers refused to cross the border. Dearborn could do nothing but march them back to Plattsburgh. British forces at this time were winning victories. They captured an American fort in northern Michigan, and Indians fighting for the British captured a fort at the place now known as Chicago. Instead of marching through Canada without difficulty, the Americans found themselves trying hard to keep the British out of the state of Ohio. For a while, the small American Navy was doing better than the Army. Just 2 months after the war started, the United States warship Constitution forced a British ship to surrender. Several months later, another American ship, the Wasp, captured the British ship Frolic. Then a frigate named the United States defeated one of Britain's most famous fighting ships, the Macedonian. The British ship was captured and brought to the United States. There were other victories at sea. At the end of 6 months, the United States Navy had captured 6 British ships and lost only one of its own vessels. Private American trade ships had been armed with guns when the war started. They, too, were successful against the British. They captured more than 300 British trade ships. But the American successes forced Britain to bring more of its fighting ships into the war with the United States. By the middle of 1813, a year after the war started, British ships controlled the East Coast. No American ship could enter or leave any port south of New England. Meanwhile, the military situation was improving for the Americans in what was then the West. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Indiana Territory, formed a large force to try to capture Detroit from the British. At the same time, Captain Oliver Perry built 5 warships on Lake Erie. With these, and 4 he already had, Perry met and defeated a British naval force. Perry reported his victory to Harrison. "We have met the enemy, and they are ours." Perry's victory and Harrison's large force caused the British to withdraw from Detroit and from a British fort at Malden in Canada. Harrison's men continued to chase the enemy. They caught them and defeated them in the Battle of the Tens. Killed in this battle was the great Indian chief Tecumseh, who had been fighting for the British. American forces made new attempts to win control of Lake Ontario and invade Canada across the Niagara River. But none of these succeeded. Late in 1813, British soldiers crossed the river and captured Fort Niagara. They also burned the town of Buffalo. By April 1814, Napoleon was forced from power in Europe, and the war between France and Britain was over. The end of the war in Europe permitted Britain to send many of its soldiers to fight against the United States. About 4,000 British soldiers landed on the Chesapeake coast, southeast of Washington. They met American forces inland at Bladensburg, a town 10 kilometers from Washington. The British soldiers broke through the American lines, and the Americans began to run away. But a group of sailors refused to retreat with their artillery. Commanded by Joshua Barney, the 400 sailors chose to stand and fight. The struggle did not last long against the 4,000 British soldiers. Barney held his position for a half hour before enemy soldiers got behind his men and silenced their guns. Barney was wounded seriously. The British thought so much of his courage that they carried him to a hospital for their own soldiers at Bladensburg. Barney himself said the British officers treated him as a brother. Once the British troops had smashed through Barney's Navy men, nothing stood between them and Washington. The commanders of the British force, General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn, took a group of men to the Capitol building and set fire to it. Then the two commanders went to the White House with the same intention. Before setting fire to the president's home, Cockburn took one of Madison's hats and the seat from one of Dolly Madison's chairs. The admiral found the president's table set for dinner. As a joke, he took a glass of wine and toasted the health of President Jemmy. President Madison had fled the White House. He crossed the Potomac River and started toward his home in Virginia. He joined his wife on the road the second day. They decided to wait about 25 kilometers from Washington. When President Madison returned to the Capitol 3 days later, the British had withdrawn. They had also burned most public buildings.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.